Today's episode comes not from Silicon Valley, but from the West African country of the Gambia. Population, 2.4 million. The capital, Banjul. Size, small. It's the smallest country in mainland Africa, smaller than the U.S. state of Connecticut. Top exports, wood, peanuts, and fish. And finally, here's a pretty cool fact. The literacy rate in the Gambia, it's 50%. So in election years, instead of writing in votes, Gambians vote by dropping marble balls into iron drums. All right, close your eyes and imagine you're walking into your local pharmacy. So if you're in the U.S., that's probably a CVS or a Walgreens. Okay, and now take a look around. Sure, you can buy toothpaste or a pack of gum, but what you'll also find, without fail, is a doctor of pharmacy, and FDA-approved OTC and prescription medications, and probably free-of-charge blood pressure testing, and blood sugar testing, and even flu shots. Now, compare this to a pharmacy in West or Sub-Saharan Africa.
All of that is non-existent. So I think a typical pharmacy just looks like a store that you walk in, like the same way you could walk in and buy a can of milk, a can of soda. You walk in, you ask for it, you leave. What's in the bottle most of the times doesn't have any labeling.
And that's exactly why Dr. Ismail Badji, Gambia born and raised, started Innovarex in his home country to bring the very first vertically integrated pharmacy and healthcare clinic to the Gambia and Sub-Saharan Africa. And now, less than 2 years after breaking ground in Banjul, the capital, in 2019, the Innovarex clinic is serving tens of thousands of people in the Gambia, giving Gambians, finally, access to safe medication and care. But for Dr. Badji, the Gambia, it's only the start. I'm David Zabinski.
And I'm Dr. Ismail Badji.
And this is not from Silicon Valley. Stories of trial and triumph from founders in emerging and frontier economies. All right, Ismail, from what I understand, you were a globetrotter of sorts growing up. Tell me a bit about that.
My family was, I was born in the capital, Banjul, which a capital from a Gambian standpoint, it's a small island of maybe 5,000 people. That's the main capital. So anything surrounding is kind of considered the capital. But yeah, I was born in the capital in 85. Don't remember much about living there because we left shortly after when I was still an infant. But my parents are from the capital as well, too. So we transitioned over. My dad's been a diplomat for a very long time, did a stint as a civil servant in the government as well, too. So his job kind of moved us to Belgium when I was a couple of years old. Lived in Brussels for 2 years and then transitioned to New Rochelle, New York, upstate New York, where I did most of my childhood up until the early 90s when my dad wanted us to kind of head on back home, get to know the culture, the people, the local languages. And just stayed in Gambia where I was for about a little bit over a decade, did most of my formidable years, middle school, high school.
And how was that? You know, being this international kid from Belgium and New York, going back to the Gambia, were you able to integrate with your classmates?
Yeah, integration was, it was interesting because I think the age that we moved back, jumping right into the school system, it wasn't uncomfortable from an academic standpoint, but just more the social nuances of being the new kid at school. I think our family, if you ask us, we've been the new guys at the school so many times where we take for granted how much that kind of shaped us with always having to adapt to a new environment. So I think school was just that. Luckily for me, I mean, sports has always been a passion. I've played it my whole life, so that always makes integration easy. Africa, as you know, is very soccer dominant. So I went back wanting to play basketball. Everybody wanted to play soccer, so I ended up having to play soccer. But academically challenging. That's one thing I could tell you about the school systems in West Africa. Very, very challenging. That is rigorous. They specialize relatively early, actually. So from ninth grade all the way till the end of high school, you basically have to choose either you're going to be a science student or a commerce student or an art student.
And I take it you chose science.
So yeah, naturally, I was a science student. So you do all the AP math, chemistry, physics. So it really prepares you for kind of life after high school.
Right. And I know you eventually got your Doctor of Pharmacy at Purdue in the U.S. So it seemed your Gambian high school science classes, they really prepared you well.
Yeah, because basically high school chemistry for us was AP courses, almost college level, honestly. I joke that my high school chemistry, physics, and biology was harder than my freshman year chemistry, physics, and biology. But it's really rigorous. The entire West Africa has this system that all 17 countries, I think, use the same curriculum, and they take the same final exam. So it is challenging, for sure.
And Ismail, this science background of yours, coupled with what I imagine would be some interesting healthcare experiences you had whilst growing up in the Gambia, these all led you to becoming a doctor of pharmacy?
You know, looking back at it, I don't know if it was, and this is where I guess my privilege will show a little bit, being that we constantly had access to travel to the U.S. over the summers. So I really did not consume a lot of Gambian healthcare growing up. Maybe a case of malaria or two where, you know, you go to the pharmacy, they give you an injection, you're drowsy for the next 2 hours. But even mentioning that as an example kind of shows you how I never got my weight taken, for example, when I went to the doctor to make sure the dose was accurate. So there's a lot of nuances now that, you know, come out later. But I really was fortunate enough to not consume a lot of the healthcare in the Gambia, even though healthcare events happened, you know, around me. I had an aunt who passed from HIV that I didn't find out till later on when I was a little bit older. All I vividly remember is her constantly having to go back and forth to this research center, coming back with a lot of medications, but it really wasn't talked about as much. Obviously, my grandma dying relatively early, maybe 2 years after we moved back home. She was only 56. So to me at that point, I still didn't understand like how diseases kind of rob people of their life. But personally, I was relatively fortunate to be insulated from most of the things that were not right with the health system.
Yeah, man, tell me about that. What isn't right about the Gambian health system?
Gambia, Africa in general, healthcare it's not preventative. It's, oh, something happened. Let's go see if it's too late or something can be done. That was always the cycle. So from a kid's eyes, like, well, everything was just perfect and all of a sudden they're gone. That's more, they don't have access to like a routine exam. There was no conversation like, oh, this is my primary doctor, or those conversations just did not happen. It was either this person is sick, how bad is it, they had to go to the hospital, or they did not make it, right? So it's like that repetitive cycle of not seeing structure in the system that now I see as just a lack of access. The doctors were probably not a lot. Most women tend to have experiences at clinics because maybe during pregnancy or just... But for men, I honestly don't even ever recall my dad while in Gambia saying, hey, I have a doctor's appointment today, now that I think about it. So the scarcity was just all over where it became normal. And I think that that's the scary part looking back at it.
Okay, so reactive care instead of proactive care. Why do you think there's this, I don't know, reluctance, unwillingness, inability amongst West Africans to go see a doctor?
I think that it's such a layered and complex situation, but scarcity is definitely one of it. The second, culturally, and I may be speaking just for Gambia, but illness, sicknesses, there's just so much stigma around it. Like families will do everything they have to do to just hide the fact that somebody's not healthy, right? So it's just not talked about. I think that has a lot to do with it, especially if it's the more stigmatized issues like sexual health issues or mental health issues, or, you know, it's just not a culture that speaks openly about health. I think that has a lot to do with it. And also just a mindset, preventative care. I don't think that concept was ever ingrained in us because people mostly times don't have a preventative mindset on a lot of things, right? A lot of cultures don't believe in, you know, birth control. A lot of cultures, you just kind of eat what you make every single day. So I think that is just more embedded. I don't think it's ever been a case where people are like, okay, let's see how we could prevent and understand what these diseases are. And ironically, a lot of it is faith. I think it's always been a juxtaposition, an interesting one, how there's so much faith in the country, sometimes to a detriment, where so many people live with the disposition that, God is good. You know, God got it covered. And it almost creates almost too much allowance for them to actually take responsibility for things like their health before it goes bad. So I think that there's that element of that as well, too. We're very prayerful people sometimes to a fault.
Yeah, but how does one address that, right? I mean, you don't want to discount people's faith, but at the same time, you also want to leverage innovations in science and medicine to help people. Ismail, what does one do?
Absolutely. And it is still a huge percentage of the population that still believe in traditional medicine more than they do modern scientific medicine. So you almost have an antagonistic, angle there where people just trust a local doctor who will mix a concoction of herbs or tree barks and they'll drink it to cure anything under the surface of the earth. So just from a scientific standpoint, you're always up against that element as well, too, which is still pervasive in the society.
Right. And so with this, I suppose, doubt on the merits of science, I take it not many Gambians have health insurance?
No, I think that's one of the biggest challenges. But for us, it's opportunity. Only about 4% of the population of 2.5 million people. So it's a very, very small number.
What? 4% of Gambians have health insurance?
Yeah, 4% have some type of health insurance. Because it's hard for me to use the word health insurance because it's more like go here and we'll pay. So it's not risk pooling. It's not outcomes driven. So I don't think the market or the sub-region has figured health insurance out yet. So a lot of them just provide you benefit or tell you, hey, you have $100 that you could spend a year on healthcare. We will only pay for it at these particular locations. That's what health insurance looks like in the Gambia. So it just makes it where if you're fighting for food on the table, your priority is not going to be getting a physical. And that's the reality, unfortunately, for a lot of individuals.
And for those that do have health insurance, what type of coverage do they get?
Most companies will give you an allocation of maybe $400 a year, right? And that's like really, really good. Private companies might give you something around the lines of that. So it's definitely not a lot of benefit based on, you know, compared to other places.
Okay. And if you are the, 96% that's not insured? Man, what happens in the event of an emergency?
Well, that's where the quandary comes into play, especially with the private and the public hospitals or the public health centers, where you could pay a measly maybe 25 cents, no, about 50 cents to get seen at a public hospital, right? But any health system that you only have to pay, you know, half a dollar to gain access, that health system is not sustainable. So there comes the scarcity. You might be seen after a couple of hours or a whole day at the hospital, but then the hospital may not have enough medications for your ailment. So you're back to the same position because you'll have to go out and buy it, and finances were the problem in the first place. So that's the main cause of why the health system is overburdened, because a lot of people, that's where they run to. Let me go to the government hospital, but the government hospital is overburdened, under-resourced, and understaffed. So the challenge is just kind of snowball effect, and it becomes worse. But a lot of people, if they make it to a government hospital, if not, it's literally sometimes at home and just back to the faith and just hoping and praying that, you know, something happens.
It's a really solemn reality. Ismail, you keep mentioning the term scarcity. Is that referring to the medicine that's available in country, to the number of hospitals?
No, not only docs. So the doctor, the physician ratio, we have one of the worst physician densities around. So it's about 9,000 to 10,000 people to one physician.
What?
Yeah, so for every Gambian, for every physician in the Gambian, there's 9 to 10,000 people. That's the ratio. Right. So about 10,000 Gambians for every physician. So interestingly, that's why Cuba exports more doctors to the Gambia than they do any commodity over the years, because their physician density is actually one of the best in the world. So they produce doctors.
Who?
Cuba.
Cuba?
Yes.
So growing up as a kid in Banjul, you saw Cuban doctors?
My whole life they've been there. That's one of their biggest commodities that they export to Gambia is doctors as well. So the country has always had a steady stream of Cuban doctors at all the public hospitals, especially, just to kind of fill the gap.
So Ismail, where are the Gambian doctors? Are they practicing elsewhere?
Yeah, practicing elsewhere. I think up until maybe, I don't think that the medical school is even 15 years old. I may be mistaken, but it's not old. So prior to that, there wasn't even an option for you to study medicine in the Gambia, right? So the few 1% to 2% of every graduating class that decided medicine is something they want to go to, you have to travel. So that's either if you can't afford a university outside in the Western world, you may go to like Ghana, for example, and West Africa's had a good program. And the likelihood of you coming back was slim to none. So I think that's where the disparity became worse. For maybe every five doctors that go, maybe we may be lucky if one, you know, decides that, hey, I'm going to forego this high paying salary and a comfortable living and go back and work in a health system where I may not have the basic tools that I need just to even do my job.
Okay. And for the, let's say, one in five that does come back, how much is he or she earning as a doctor in Gambia?
Not a lot. I don't think there's Gambian doctors, especially from a healthcare system. I don't know what the exact salary is, but I could bet money that they don't make even $1,000 a month, right? If they did, that's a ridiculously good salary anyways from a Gambian standard. But it's just not a lot. Most doctors, let's say in the U.S., make more in maybe a half a day from an hourly standpoint than some doctors in Africa make in a whole month, just to give you context, right?
Yeah, so a Gambian doctor with accreditation abroad is obviously incentivized far more elsewhere than he or she is back in the Gambia. But aside from salary, Ismail, how would the infrastructure amongst Gambian hospitals be compared to those abroad?
Yeah, so one of the things, because it's as if you get trained as in any profession, you're getting trained to practice at the top of your license, meaning you need electronic health records because that's how medicine should be practiced, where there's, you could trace, track, record everything. Well, that doesn't exist in most places in the Gambia, right? Basic tools, diagnostic tools, shortages of, there's times where hospitals would run out of water, right? And if we mention these things, most of the times it sounds almost too fictional. Like, how could a whole hospital run out of water? Well, it happens, right? So you can't imagine, you could be a Harvard medical school doctor who decides to go to Gambia, and then you're struggling with finding running water, right? So it just shows you the stark inadequacies that exist in them. But everything, resources are just constantly in shortage, especially in the public sector. And in the private sector, once again, very few could afford it. So most doctors that do spend time in the private sector, it's still a game of scarcity either way.
All right, here is my naive, probably ignorant question. But Ismail, how much is the Ministry of Health funding the healthcare system in the Gambia?
Man, not enough. I don't think there's never been enough. And I think that's been the biggest obstacle there, I think, in the history of the Gambia. There's just not a time period where I could look back with, like, you know what, the healthcare system was adequately funded. I think on average, we spend less than 10% of government spending goes to healthcare, which is nowhere near enough, especially if, you know, citizens are not contributing, actually paying for healthcare to sustain the system. So it's not nearly enough spending. And obviously, you have problems where a lot of it is donor funded. So that comes with a lot of stipulations in terms of direction, inadequacies or inefficiencies in how the money is spent is a problem across the entire sub-region. So it's just a host of issues that makes it not a well-run system. And I don't think there hasn't been a blueprint on how to run it efficiently. And I don't think the private sector is also leveraged enough to kind of help fill the gap.
All right, man, you very clearly and succinctly painted the pretty gloomy, dark picture that is the Gambian healthcare system. But you're doing something about it, much of which you attribute to Walgreens.
No, I mean, that's the best thing that ever happened to my career. I think I wouldn't be even where I am now without Walgreens. Walgreens has taught me so many valuable lessons because, granted, I started Walgreens 5 years before going to pharmacy school. So I literally started as a cashier up front and trained back as a pharmacy technician. So I've worked every single position you can work in a Walgreens pharmacy over a span since 2008. So that was really my introduction on how healthcare should be delivered, especially in a community standpoint, because I think Walgreens has done that better than any, you know, chain pharmacy or clinic.
Right. And while at Walgreens, you saw what you call the evolution of the pharmacy.
Yeah, because I was paying attention to what was happening in the not only the profession, but in the industry, where how technology was moving at a pace where now people were aligning their business models to kind of make room for rapid diagnostics, vaccinations by pharmacists, because all these pharmacists who were coming out of school overqualified, honestly, and underutilized. So I think there's been a shift in more pharmacists doing more disease state management, medication therapy management. So I kind of witnessed the evolution. And to me, I was like, okay, this doesn't have to happen in the U.S., now and wait 50 years for it to happen overseas. It could be simultaneously because technology is, you know, is a great equalizer.
What do you mean by that?
It's such a great and I'll give you an example, especially from a U.S. context, right? There's a Walgreens or a CVS. The pharmacist as a profession is the most probably accessible healthcare professional there is in a lot of communities, right, where even if you don't have a hospital, there's a pharmacy in the area. So if a pharmacist is, let's say, trained to be able to check what your cholesterol level is, to be able to tell you if you're a diabetic or run an A1C test, right, within 5 minutes, you're shifting somebody's access that could have been like a 2-hour drive to the closest doctor's hospital waiting for an appointment to like a 15-minute interaction with a healthcare professional that they trust, because they seeing that person who comes in maybe to grab a gallon of milk and run back to grab their cholesterol medicine, there's a relationship there. So I think that equalizer from a technology standpoint, it leverages relationships that, you know, pharmacists tend to already have. But now you're speeding up the process at which clinical information could be acquired for interventions to happen, some of them which can be life-saving. And you contrast that to Africa.
Yeah, let's contrast the one-stop shop model of a U.S. pharmacy to an African pharmacy. What does a pharmacy in the Gambia look like?
Commercial in nature. It's the most transactional experience that should not be transactional. And this is not even a Gambia thing. I think just the sub-region. Pharmacy practice, it's seen differently. And I think even a pharmacist is seen differently. Because in the U.S., I mean, now every pharmacist has a doctor of pharmacy. If a pharmacist has a cold and has to go home, the entire pharmacy closes down, because legally you cannot operate a pharmacy you can't dispense medication without pharmacy supervision.
All right. So to help accelerate the evolution of Gambian pharmacies and healthcare systems, as opposed to waiting, in your words, 50 years, means you had to do something. When'd you start?
I think around 2018, because I left my job at February 2018 that was the last time I got a paycheck. I remember it because it's been a long year and a half.
Okay, and what would that business look like?
Well, initially we said, okay, let's go. Pharmacy is something we could do in our sleep, because pharmacy operations, very, very comfortable area of expertise. But that's not enough. We don't want to be a pharmacy. We never just wanted to be a pharmacy, even though we could, from day one, we knew we'll be the most innovative pharmacy in the country has ever seen, right? With the technology, the labeling, the knowledge, we knew that. We wanted to be more, because going back to the backdrop of what the health system was lacking, it was lacking basic preventative stuff, right? It was lacking disease state management. So we incorporate all of that from day one because we knew we wanted to do that. And even if we can do it, we knew we had a network of healthcare professionals.
So not just a pharmacy.
No. So we built it as a healthcare solutions company. We basically set out to let's go out and see how best we could leverage technology to keep people as healthy as possible. And if that involves pharmacy, then we have that in our back pocket. So that's how we build the company, right? So doing disease state management, because I've always been passionate about diabetes and hypertension management. I actually found out I was hypertensive when I was 27. Yeah, so that's what killed my grandmother at 56. My mom is hypertensive. She's diabetic. So it's personal for me because I'm like, okay, I didn't get to know my grandmother because she died at 56. Like dying at 56, it's early, but the life expectancy for a man in Gambia is 61 years old, right? So it just goes to show you, like, I'm 35, I'm past 50% if I was born and raised in the Gambia, just based on statistics. And if you peel layers of that, it's healthcare, right? Most men may not even see a doctor, but unless there's an emergency. So that's what we set out to do. Like, let's leverage point of care testing because the technology makes it easy for you to find out on a basic level how healthy somebody is. We build that into the business model.
Okay. And after you test someone and you find out he or she is sick?
Okay. Once we find out that people are sick, they have diabetes and hypertension, we don't want to be a transactional pharmacy, which is what exists in the entire sub-region. You walk in, prescription or not, hey, could I get 20 amoxicillins? It'll be $5. You pay your $5, you go out the way. That's how pharmacy is practiced in Africa. But just to add a little bit of context, there's no such thing as like, where's your prescription most of the times? Which doctor wrote it for you? You walk in, you ask for what you want, you pay for it, and you leave, right? So we had to change that paradigm. Like, okay, let's start managing people to let them know you're diabetic. It's not going to go away. You need this medication every single month. You need to take it. So we added all that into it.
Right. So to build this one-stop shop health solution center, what was step one?
Step one was actually building relationships, right? So we knew, okay, our business model required a couple of things. Supply chain, one, critical importance. And we figured, even though we knew the India market was very advantageous in terms of sourcing, The downside to that market as well, to where it is good, there's always bad players. All right. So it is also a substandard market. So with drug manufacturing, what a lot of people don't realize is for you to be able to sell in the US through the FDA, your manufacturing plant has to be in good standing. They actually call it good manufacturing practices, right? So it's a stamp of approval that, okay, you are kosher to sell to the US. That's not all the medications that are in circulation in the world. There's a huge component of substandard counterfeit medications. And substandard meaning the tablet could say 100 milligrams of amoxicillin, but there's probably maybe 20 milligrams in it. But who cares anyways, because where you're sending it, they don't have the infrastructure in place to be able to test it upon arrival to say, hey, Dave, this should be 100 milligrams. Why is it 20? But from a business standpoint, it makes sense because you don't have any waste. So even if you have a two-tier system, everything that does not pass to go to the US, it's not waste. There's a market for it, right? And I think that's how the African market, if you ask me, that's one of the reasons why it evolved to be a billion-dollar industry just for substandard and counterfeit medications. Because from a manufacturing standpoint, you don't have any waste. It's more efficient, right?
Wait, what? How big is the counterfeit medication market in Africa?
It's a billion-dollar industry. It's a billion-dollar industry. And this is from fake medications produced on the continent, substandard medications brought into the continent. It's a lucrative business because, once again, there's no way of telling because people's well-being and healthcare, it's not at the forefront. It's a purely sound business model because you're selling products that cannot be verified as substandard at market price. And the person taking it on the other end, if it's a headache, if it's a lot of things that you can subjectively measure if the medication is working to the desired effect, there's no way of telling. And drug manufacturer, you know, manufacturing is rooted in that process. Like, is it safe? You check. Is it effective? Check. Then it's good to go on the market, right? So the U.S. and the FDA, just we knew when we were establishing relationships for supply chain, it had to be from the U.S. Not because there's something particularly special, but there's familiarity. Because once again, I worked at Walgreens. I managed inventory. I understood how the supply chain system worked. But also, we knew that anything that we source from the U.S., one, we have the level of assurance knowing that if somebody's grandmother is taking it in the Gambia, that it's the right thing, right? So that was important. So that was step number one. Build the relationships for supply chain, both for over-the-counter products and for prescription medications, and then for point-of-care testing equipment.
Okay, and step two?
Secure those things and then started figuring out how do we get one brick and mortar up and running. Because our business model was never designed to be 100 brick and mortars all over the city, because it's not efficient. There's a lot of expense associated with it, and it's more risk. We figured, being that we build Wellness on Wheels, which is our logistics arm of the company, it allows us to operate more efficiently with one brick and mortar at a centralized location in the country and then leverage delivery to get products and services to people. So that's exactly what we did. And obviously the fun part, as I say, the never ending part is fundraising.
Yeah, exactly. How much would all of this cost?
So we figured it was going to cost us about $250,000 to kind of get everything up and running with inventory, startup costs.
Okay, and in trying to raise $250,000, when you told investors you wanted to build an integrated pharmacy and health solution center in the Gambia, what was their reaction?
I think for a lot of people, all they hear when it comes to anything in Africa is like, why? Like, there's just too much risk involved. And why? And some of them is personal. Why? Because they're like, okay, well, you have a six-figure job. You graduated from a good school. You have a great job. Why? Why now? Why Africa? Right. So you have that set of people, and some people lean in with more curiosity because they're like, okay, tell me what you're thinking. What do you see? So it was mixed. I think the good thing is, like, our minds, my mind especially, was so made up before I really started having conversations with people about it, where nothing would have wavered it. But you get a mix, even from a family perspective, your loved ones, because they just know the market. Nobody's ever done it before, right? And I think that's always a burden of being the first, because there's nothing to compare it to. We had a business model. We made some educated guesses on where we think we're going to be, but no, there's no benchmark. You become the benchmark.
So to be the first without a benchmark, I suppose you had to find investors that probably knew you pretty well. I imagine most were Americans?
Yeah. No, about 98% of all the investors are Americans. They live in the States. Obviously, a lot of them of African descent. But they also, I think what resonated with them, a lot of them had stories like my grandmother. Or they still do have parents who their biggest worry is, how am I going to make sure, one, they're healthy, but two, they have healthcare services that are familiar not only to me, but give me the level of assurance knowing that they have an opportunity to live a longer life that does not include the burden of me buying a plane ticket and bringing them over to the U.S. just so that they could see a doctor, right? So I think a lot of people who invested in our company early, those were their pain points. We were trying to solve some of their pain points.
Okay, and when you finally raised that money, when were you able to finally break ground?
2019 is when we finally broke ground, because it's a gradual process. So a lot of the things that we were doing, it was like just accumulating stuff, right? We build good relationships. We actually, funny story is, like, I had a good mentor of mine who had an independent pharmacy in Charlotte that was bought out by Walgreens. So, and I was working at Walgreens at the time. So Walgreens actually sent me to do the merger and acquisition. So I had a conversation with him, like, hey, by the way, what are you doing with all this shelving that you have? Because you no longer need a pharmacy. So we actually got all the shelving that from a closing independent pharmacy. And those are the shelves at the Inovarex in Gambia. as well too. So just little things like that, just finding things to kind of set up a pharmacy from scratch, turned my garage into a make-do pharmacy with all the computer systems to test it out. Just gradually accumulating stuff and relationships up and leading up to 2019 in September when we actually opened the facility.
And the reception from the local Gambians?
Yeah, no, honestly, the reception from the people was inspiring. And I think because so much of what we did in terms of communicating our why was to the people in the diaspora. And I'll tell you why. Because we figured Gambia, if you do strictly research on how much money, spending power, healthcare spending is in the Gambia, you cannot run a business off of that. So we started communicating like in early 2019 to Gambians who lived outside of the Gambia, like, hey, this is who we are. We're a U.S. company. We're young African healthcare professionals. These are the things we want to do for your loved ones back home, right? So we started that early. So I think if anything, more people outside the Gambia, especially in the U.S., knew about us before we even opened ground in the Gambia, right? So once we got to the ground and up and running, I think word of mouth and just people knowing, and also just scarcity, right? Because most people struggle with finding medications that they know it's going to work every single time. And the good thing about relationships is we don't have middlemen just to get these products. So we're getting it at a really competitive price where now it's literally cheaper to get products from the U.S., from our facility in the Gambia, than it is walking into a U.S. pharmacy.
Okay, and Ismail, how about folks outside the capital, Banjul, in the more rural areas? You're offering delivery, right? That's true healthcare e-commerce.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the benefit of Gambia as a pilot country, because you could run the entire, from point A to point Z in the Gambia in about 6-7 hours, right? So it's not a big country. Most places are within a 3-4 hour drive, right? Which is why it doesn't make sense to invest in a lot of brick and mortar when you could have delivery fleets all over just making deliveries, right? So it's just more efficient. But yeah, that's what we've created. And it's never been done in any product or service for you to be able to get that expediency. And this is life-changing for a lot of people because it's medications. During COVID, it was symptomatic relief for people who were at home recovering from COVID. And you tie around the ability not only to get the product to you now, but to have telemedicine where when you get the product, as long as you have basic internet, which a lot of people are using mobile data, you could, you know, have a conversation with a professional to tell you what to do. It's not only revolutionary, I think, in the Gambia, but I think that's where healthcare is going all over the world. It's fast, it's convenient, it's reliable, and it gives a lot of value to the community.
And aside from offering U.S. FDA-approved medications and telemedicine services, there's another facet of the InnovRx business model, and that's the subscription model, right?
Yes. Yeah, so Assurance Care Plan, which is the main subscription, it costs, and this is the one that a lot of people are just buying for their loved ones who live in the Gambia. It costs $760 a year, and it gives you one physical to begin with, so a comprehensive screening where we do about 14 different tests just to assess how healthy you are. It gives you allocations for up to 4 generic medications a month at no cost. It gives you a 10% permanent discount on all our online or retail products in store online, and free delivery anywhere in the Gambia, right? So it's pretty much like a zero copay healthcare plan that gives you free delivery wherever you are.
So effectively, a health insurance that actually works.
And once again, with Augusta, one that is backed by risk pooling and outcomes, because we're able to track and measure how healthy these individuals are. And from a clinical standpoint, diabetes, hypertension, if it's bad, the situation is bad, you need more medications to manage it. If it's managed well, you need less medications most of the times because there's a lot of adjustments that happen. But the cornerstone to a lot of these diseases from a clinical standpoint, the number one most critical factor is adherence. How are we making sure that a patient is getting the pill they need every single day to keep their blood pressure under control? But if you're getting it to them every single month, you're having telemedicine sessions, you're calling in, the success rate, because you remove all the barriers that normally will get in the way with an individual ending up with complicated diabetes that ends up in an amputation or dying early, right? So it's the value, I mean, and the alternative is a plane ticket for a lot of these individuals. So the value proposition has been high from day one.
Okay, probably a pretty obvious question, but one that needs to be asked. For those that can't afford the almost $800 a year to subscribe, can they still get the same service on, say, an a la carte basis?
Absolutely. And even if you don't have a care plan, you could still request an in-house visit to get a diagnostic test done. You could request, obviously, you'll pay for it a la carte, but you'll pay for it. You could request a prescription refill to be delivered to your home. So it was just healthcare delivered in the most convenient way all around, even for people who lived in the Gambia. And interestingly, for companies, because once again, a lot of companies still don't know how best to take care of their employees because there's no structured health plan. So with our corporate packages, it allowed a lot of institutions now to use us as a primary place for their employees to seek the care and wellness that they need.
Okay, so from your subscription revenues, your medication and prescription sale revenues, your health insurance, how are the numbers in 2020?
Yeah, so 2020, early on, our first year, we projected like, hey, if we make 180K, we won't break even, but it'll be a good year. We made $360,000 last year. And significant portion of that came between April and December.
Okay, and the breakdown?
Yeah, products and services, medication sales, prescriptions, because honestly, that's our most valuable product is a prescription going back to the health insurance scarcity. So we literally built health insurance within the company because once again, we were vertically aligned. So you could enter the healthcare system and you could see a doctor, get the required lab test done to find out what's going on, get a pharmacy prescription and deliver it to your home. So that is literally from an Africa standpoint, that's normally five different companies that you have to interact with, but we're vertically aligned. So we just didn't want to capitalize that. We wanted to turn that into a product from a subscription that locked people in to stay in that cycle continuously. So a significant portion of our revenue came from subscription sales, but e-commerce retail as well too, it's relatively new. So a lot of people, the convenience of people's loved ones being able to buy basic things like baby powder and just ibuprofen on our platform and getting it delivered anywhere in the Gambia where it first of its kind. So it's just convenience and timing.
Right. And so within this vertical integration, much of it is in thanks, correct me if I'm wrong, to your, I want to get this right, cloud-based electronic medical records or EMRs that you offer in partnership with a US company.
Absolutely. No, yeah, Agasta, for me, it's the most valuable product relationship that we have. So we knew that we wanted to be, I don't want to say modern, because it's just status quo. In the U.S., you're not going to run a facility without electronic health record system. So we went out to get one for us to run in the Gambia. But luckily, we, you know, met the owner of Agasta because it's not open source, so it's proprietary, but very customizable. Very nimble. So we built a relationship. He had a product that he was trying to enter the Africa market. We were a company entering the Africa market. So I think the relationship was just, the timing was just perfect. So we built a partnership. He came on board as one of the minority owners for IGH. And Agasta became our product to sell to a new region that did not have any penetration when it comes to electronic health record systems that was cloud-based.
And aside from digitizing a lot of the Gambian healthcare in the next few years, Ismail, what goals do you have for the rest of the region? Do you want to expand?
Absolutely. So the strategy for Gambia is just to kind of expand the logistics arm, more moving towards like lock boxes at strategic locations. So if it's a rural hospital, putting a WOW station there that's lock boxes where we could just remotely put things and people could have access to. That's the strategy there, not a brick and mortar. But in terms of the sub-region, Sierra Leone, Ghana, Liberia, literally replicating what we're doing in Gambia in those sub-region because there's direct, you know, application there. Their challenges are the same. Their diaspora spending is higher actually than Gambia, but even internally, their healthcare spending dollars are actually more significant than Gambia. So that's the strategy.
This will all require a bit more fundraising, no?
Absolutely. Our fundraising efforts hasn't ended. We're trying to raise $350,000 for this year to kind of run on between the next 12 months. So that's still ongoing. We're still offering convertible notes. We just got invested on and by Startup Health, which has been good just from an exposure standpoint. So we're looking forward to how we could leverage that relationship, that ecosystem as well. So the fundraising, it's ongoing. It doesn't get any easier because it's still Africa. So despite how promised it is, you know, I don't think any company in Gambia, for example, has attracted venture capitalists, for example, in the traditional way. So it's just a ton of challenges. I think any business in the U.S., if you had, you know, the traction that we were showing, it would be a much easier to kind of raise funds.
Yeah, traction. Speaking of traction, how is 2021 looking? I mean, you had over $365,000 worth of business in 2020. So how are things looking this year?
Great start. Off to a great start. I think the first quarter, we made $110,000 in Q1. So we're looking forward to what Q2 will look like, especially Q3. And the third quarter specifically because the supply chain challenges during COVID affected everybody the same, right? So I think we're just now entering the phase where we're getting all our replenishments, some of them that we've ordered. Because once again, that's the downside to doing business overseas, where anything you put on a ship, the container could tell you 45 days, it may get there in 90 days. So there's a lot of turnover. We're really, really hoping that at least at the end of the year, we may land anywhere between $600,000 to $700,000 for the year.
Right. And Ismail, if you're seeing thousands of Gambian patients per year, generating hundreds of thousands and soon millions of dollars worth of healthcare-related revenue, I'm sure lots of Gambian eyes will be on you. What's your message to the Gambian founders working on something now?
Just do it well enough where it's a global solution too. And I think that's important, moving away from just creating a Gambia idea or an Africa idea, but more so something that could compete globally because it just solves the problems of a lot of people that have challenges to solutions that you're offering. But you got to have a lot of wherewithal and just be able to just stick it through.
That was Dr. Ismail Badji from InnovRx Global on Not From Silicon Valley. Stay tuned as we interview founders from all around the world, from Nigeria to Mongolia, Egypt to Colombia, Kazakhstan to the Philippines, and everywhere in between. We'll see you next time.